The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thanks, Peter. It's great to be here. I love City Bible Forum Legal. The question time even more than the talks, especially when I'm giving them. And so please do write your questions. It'd be great to have some back and forward over this. Particularly as it is, as Peter said, just such a strange little book. Esther is one of those ones where as they're putting together the canon of the scriptures, what's in, what's out. It was one of those ones where they thought, really, does this belong? Here's a book that doesn't mention God. His name isn't there at all. Here's a book where there's no prayer, there's no worship, there's no discussion of religion. It's far away from Israel. It follows Jews who are in exile and haven't returned to the promised land with those who seem much better and more faithful. A lot of the characters are deeply kind of compromised. There's no miraculous act from God that intervenes into this situation. There's no apocalyptic prophecy that explains what's going on. Instead, we've got what is at oftentimes a very tawdry tale about power in the ancient world. But for that very reason, it feels like there's a lot of connections to the world around us today. As you see King Xerxes, it's hard not to see him echoed in some of the people holding power at the moment. It's set in exile. God's people had been taken into captivity by the Babylonians and then by the Assyrians, and now we're up to the Persians who'd smashed the Babylonians and were at war with the Greeks as this is being written. This is around the same time that Herodotus describes the battles between Persia and Greece. It's around the same time as Aristotle, just to kind of set it for you. And the people of God here are pretty much a footnote to the bigger story of what's going on in the world. If there was an interesting story about the Jews in Israel, it was one that happened a long time ago and far, far away. It really wasn't the main way to understand what is happening in the world today. If you want to understand the action, then you look to where the power is. And more, God's people seem to be just in the decline, in the past, belonging to history, and not at the forefront of the action. If you want to see where the action is, you go to the power, and you get this beautiful description of power in the opening few verses. During the time of Xerxes, who rules over 127 provinces, from India to Kush, this was the world power. Imagine an empire that stretches from India to Ethiopia, up through Syria, into Turkey, across Afghanistan, and kind of everything within that boundary. Massive, massive empire. There would be, if you lived at it at the time, there would be no real way to escape it. There would be no way to go outside the bounds of the empire. And one man sat there at the top, King Xerxes. Not a king who just gets wheeled out for ceremonial fate openings and things like that. Not a man who's subject to spills and in intrigue or even elections, but one who holds absolute power. A king who can summon armies, invade lands. His word is life and death. His enemies will be impaled on stakes outside his palace. And all hail the great and mighty King Xerxes. If you walk through the British Museum, you'll still see room after room after room telling the annals of some of these kings, and Xerxes is prominent there. And there's still reliefs of the impaled victims of King Xerxes writhing away on the stakes as they've been impaled. His citadel is in Susa, northern Iran. And the citadel there is not just a palace, not just a throne room, but it's like the parliamentary triangle in Canberra, but with teeth, right? So you've got all the centre of power, foreign affairs and treasury and the army. Everything happens here in this citadel, and the glorious description of it matches the kind of best efforts of the banks in Sydney to look more impressive than the other, or the big firms, or the chambers, or whatever it is might be. You've got the best view, the best furnishings, the best art, the most beautiful view of the harbour. It's all here in this citadel. And he gathers together the rulers of and the military leaders from all of his empire, and for 180 days he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom, the splendour of his glory and his majesty. Some of it's described there in terms of the blue linen, the gardens, the silver, the marble pillar, the couches of gold, and the couches of gold. Herodotus describes this as well. It says that one time when the Athenians had fought with the Persians in a battle and the Persians fled, they left behind them couches of gold. Not coins or necklaces, but couches, right? When these guys go camping, they bring their gold couches. Kanye has nothing on them, right, for bling. This is an empire of excess and gold and extravagant kind of wealth. And it's done in a very showy way. The Citadel is designed to do that. I've just spent the last couple of days in Canberra and was in Parliament House, and it's interesting as you go in there, I'm sure it's designed to impress. You know, you walk in and there's those marble forest at the entrance and then into the Great Hall and the big tapestries, and you can see the delegations coming in from China yesterday and they're looking around and seeing what's on offer. And this is our attempt to kind of say, here's a great and powerful nation that you're dealing with here. But all of that would pale despite alongside this kind of display that we're meant to be impressed with. And as he gathers all those military rulers, it's not just to have it's that time of year, let's have a party. There's intent here. It's a show of power to gather them for such a time, probably to plot the next war against Greece. And here is Xerxes. He says that the king's command, verse 8, every guest is allowed to drink with no restrictions, right? The bar is open. And the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished, right? Just men here. Terrible gender bias that takes place under Xerxes, but just men, and the bar is open. Here he is, all power, the crowd around him, and what does he do? He is absolutely drunk, in high spirits from wine. He's drunk is probably a better translation. And as he's there, he commands the seven eunuchs who served him. You see that there where the number 10 is. And then they're listed to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the peoples and nobles. Now, there's a dark element that comes here, isn't it? Like, you've got this room full of drunk military leaders, all being shown how much power and glory he has, and to crown it off, he brings out the trophy wife, the one who's so beautiful that all will kind of gasp. And it's ego at work, it's misogyny, it's sexist, it's power, but it's still recognisable in our world, isn't it? That this kind of way of running empires hasn't changed. And here he is doing it. But the twist in the tale is that Vashti refuses to come out. When the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. And then the king is just burning with anger. The one who's supposed to have all this power can't actually bend the will of his queen. I mean, he could have brought her out in chains. He had that kind of power, but he couldn't command her authority and respect and love. And we're not told why she doesn't come out. We can probably guess. But can you imagine the fear of those eunuchs having to come back into that drunken assembly and saying that Queen Vashti won't be coming out to see you? And in his anger, he calls in the lawyers, right? Nothing like having a good, angry, drunk client wanting your immediate attention. And so here they are, the experts in the law, who are called on to give an advice on the spot about this great crisis that's gripped the land. According to the law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. And the response comes, Queen Vashti's done wrong not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. Right? Refusing this drunk king is not just a problem within the marriage, it's a problem within the empire. The whole empire is going to be affected if news of this comes out. If the queen's conduct become known to all the women, they'll all despise their husbands, and they say, and they'll follow her example. They'll take a lesson from her. This very day, Persian and Median women of the nobility who've heard about the queen's conduct will respond to the king's nobles in the same way. There'll be no end of disrespect, of discord, right? They're beating up the fear of what could take place. You know, the world could end. All these wives will stop obeying their husbands, all because Queen Vashti hasn't come out to her drunken King Xerxes. Again, we're in the world of... You can just imagine people starting to tweet, you know, what should Vashti do? Why did she say no? You know, how do we understand what's kind of taking place here? How is he going to respond? And the response here from the lawyers is saying, well, this is not just a personal thing now. This really is an insult to the whole empire. And so let's have a response, a royal decree, verse 19. Issue a royal decree, let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which can't be repealed. Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Give that to someone else. And then he does that, and you see there at 22, he sends that message out to the whole empire. Now, weirdly, if you think about it, you know, she refuses to come in, and what's the advice? Well, you're not going to be allowed to come in. And their fear is that the whole empire will find out. And so what do they do? Well, they say, well, make sure you publish this among the whole empire. And so you're wondering how good this advice is and how good they are at crisis management right from the start. But Xerxes relies on crisis management advisors. Every time through the book we'll see a crisis comes up, he never takes his own initiative in something. The man with all power is the one who relies on these people who give advice that actually you start to wonder how good it actually is. And I think we're supposed to read this with a bit of a wry smile. I think we're supposed to read this and think, well, maybe he's not so powerful after all. Maybe that thing that looks so alluring in this empire of the world is not as great as you think. If he really is the top of the tree, then it's a bit like the... I don't know if you've seen the jokes that Reagan used to tell against communism. It's worth Googling on YouTube. Reagan used to regularly tell jokes that people within the Soviet Empire told against themselves, and they're hilarious. And there's a power that comes with laughter. There's a very kind of subversive thing that can come against a tyrant when people laugh at the way that they don't have the power that they pretend to have. And I think that's what we're seeing in play here. The empire of the world in Persia and today, for all its visible impressiveness, maybe isn't as powerful as the thing we think it is. And I think that if that's true, then there's a warning for us not to be sucked into living for the empires of this world and for things that seem powerful and glorious. Well, if chapter 1 speaks of power, chapter 2, and we're going to do chapter 2 very quickly, speaks of weakness, desperate kind of weakness. Xerxes sobers up, calms down, remembers Vashti, is sad, but he can't change the law because the law's been made now. And so they come to him with other advice. Let's have a search made for beautiful young virgins for the king. And so from the whole empire, this search takes place to bring virgins in to find a new queen. Concubines come, and one of them is going to be chosen. And it might sound like an ancient, you know, bachelorette kind of show, but when you think about it for just a moment, you realise actually it's far darker than that. You've actually got something here which is exploitative kind of sex trading. So, you know, just as, you know, bringing Vashti before that drunken crowd looks bad, like, what is going on here? That these virgins will be ripped out of the family and home and land where they are to be brought before this king. And the way it worked was that that he would spend a night with each of them, and then if they were to be sent into a life where they would never sleep with anyone else, would never marry another, and would never see him again, because he'd be on to the next one. That system of, you know, just misogynistic exploitation is the flip side of what power looks like. You know, empires seem to do this. It seems to be the way that it takes place. Now, you know, it's not Esther's not written as a feminist text, and, you know, it would be a mistake to use that kind of reading to explain everything that's going on here, or for us to try and read it as a moral thing where, you know, is this good or bad? But the story which is told, we can't help but see some of the way that power and weakness relate. And I think that's the point that's being made here. Just as the eunuchs which are being used are boys who would have been chosen and brought into the castrated and used in the civil service there, the girls were sent into harems. And the empire of power depends on using people in this kind of slavery, which takes them and eats them up and consumes them body and soul. This is not a beautiful picture of empire. It's a kind of peeling back and seeing what's going on underneath, where people are owned. And it's all great if you're the king, but not so great if you're anyone else. But in chapter 2, we also see a description of Mordecai, verse 5, who's introduced to us as a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin. But where is he? He's in the citadel of Susa. So here is a Jew. So there's a connection here to the bigger story of the Bible, to God's people. But what's he doing here? Why hasn't he returned to Jerusalem when he's been free to do that? Why hasn't he gone with others? Has he compromised? Has he been sold out? And if you think that, then his name kind of suggests that as well. For he's named Mordecai. It sounds Jewish today, but only because of Mordecai. Then it's named after. But Mordecai comes from Marduk, one of the Persian gods. And so here is one who sounds dreadfully kind of compromised in the introduction that we have to him. And he's the one who's looked after Esther as a child. And Esther, also named after a Persian goddess, is a lovely figure and she's beautiful. And when the king's order is proclaimed, she goes into this system is given the best place there in the harem. And look at verse 10. So we're on the back side, chapter 2, verse 10. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. So there's an ominous note here that, you know, keep your identity hidden. Don't reveal who you are. That's going to be one of the big themes that run through Esther. Is she going to be outing herself as a Jew, as one of God's people, or is she going to compromise like it seems that Mordecai has? And at this stage, she's not revealing herself, she's not outing herself, and she goes through the whole beauty regime that takes place. And when the turn comes for Esther, the king is pleased with her like no one else. She wins his favour and approval more than any of the other virgins, and she is given the crown. So she's appointed as the queen. Another feast, another holiday, the whole empire kind of understands what's going on. And there we have her going into the place that Vashti had held. Then there's this strange footnote at the end, the last few verses which are there, where Mordecai overhears a plot. He's sitting at the king's gate where a lot of the business would have been done. He overhears a conspiracy to assassinate the king. He finds out, he tells Esther, Esther tells the king. It's reported, put into the archives, that they were big on bureaucracy. Lots of bureaucracy, excellent bureaucrats. And we still have some of that bureaucracy on clay tablets left for us. And the two officials who were plotting, well, they were impaled on poles, right? They knew how to do justice that even the telegraph would approve of, right? So there they are impaled on piles, the enemies of the king. And so here we have Esther, who's now come into the very heart of the court, but she's next to a dangerous, powerful man. What will happen next? We'll come back next week. Or read on yourself. But what we see here in this opening is this, I think, this contrast between this powerful world empire that maybe isn't as great and grand as it appears, and a weak woman who's an outsider, who won't even reveal her identity, who's going to be the key player as the story progresses. Do we know how Vashti became queen? Was it an earlier beauty parade? No, we don't know. Not her by name. We know that these kind of things took place, and there are other records of that, but not her by name at that time. Would anyone at the time that this is written have considered Queen Vashti to have been treated unjustly? I imagine so. I mean, I think if you're in the room and you're watching, drunk King Xerxes, you would have been a little scared about how he was going to exercise his power, and it was just capricious. And, you know, whether it's right or wrong, it's just a question that he's the one with all power. And so it's not so much right or wrong, it's power and glory, and he's the one with it, and so all hail to him, or find yourself on a pole. I understand that Esther's the only book in the Bible that doesn't mention God. Why is it in the canon? It's true. The absence of God is one of the really striking things in this book. There's no mention of God's name, but also there's no explicit kind of identification of God being at work. But look, isn't that, if you were to write a history of Australia and wanting to understand what's taken place, how many of those histories are going to say, and then God did this? Now, does that mean that God is absent? And that he has nothing to do with this world at this time? I mean, it's not like the Exodus, where the waters are parted, and, you know, it's not like here's God speaking through the prophet Isaiah. You could tell a story of Australia, of the world, over the last 200 years, that didn't name God. Does that mean God's absent? I don't think so. I think God is present and acting even when not named. And the challenge, I think, for the people of God in this world is to say, how do you live in a world that's happy to say that God's not there at all, and there's no kind of specific acts that you can authoritatively kind of say, here is an act of God. Not talking about insurance, but you know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of... So there are similarities, I think, between her world and ours. Should we too be careful in disclosing certain matters when dealing with others? Yeah. In terms of that, disclosing her own identity, her faith identity, that challenge and that tension, I think, is one that I don't want to answer yet, but which is real in the book and which is a real issue for us. Like, is there a wisdom in what she does in holding back her identity? Is that fear? Is that wisdom? How is that going to play out? Let's come back and see how that works. Is the point of the story that Esther puts her people, the Jews, ahead of her own destiny? She saves her people and resembles Joseph, who rescues his people, and later Jesus, who rescues the world. Okay, one of the things we haven't seen yet is that there's going to be this terrible plot develops that one of Xerxes' main leaders is going to plan for the destruction of all the Jews throughout the empire, and Esther is going to be key to seeing them saved. That is a story. Sorry to keep saying come back, but you do need to come back and see. And she doesn't look like the kind of heroine you might expect, right? But when God sends people to rescue his people, isn't that always the case? I mean, who would send a baby, right? And yet that's the way God is at work. In fact, this story, just as a teaser, this story was, because it goes through this planned genocide that failed and is still remembered by Jewish people today, it was banned by Hitler. And within some of the death camps, they had memorised it and set it out, you know, secretly. And it was a real message of hope that their enemies would be impaled and that God would save them in the most unlikely circumstances. Are there references to Esther and Mordecai in the annals and records of Persians and the Medes? I'm not sure. That's a good question. I'd need to take that on notice. There certainly is to the reign of Xerxes, and even probably to this banquet, because we've got it dated to the right year, and we know that there's a massive banquet that takes place where he's planning another invasion of Greece. And this is that banquet this year is the kind of the high point. If you want to talk to the glory days, before things kind of go bad in Persia, then it was this dinner. And I think that's part of the point, that, you know, the story is told at the very most impressive part of the history. Many have laughed at the church about the power the church often pretends to have. How should Christians respond when being laughed at? How should Christians talk about power? It's interesting, isn't it? Like, I'm not sure if you saw the editorial in Sydney Morning Herald on Monday, which said, look, we just don't need protections for religious freedom. This is just privilege for an age which has passed. The church doesn't have that kind of power now. All they're moaning about is a loss of power. There's no legitimate kind of concern which is there. That's what shorthand for where it said. There's a real debate going on about the place of the church and the power. You'd need to talk about the Royal Commission too, and what it's seen. What's a Christian perspective on it? Well, part of it comes out of Esther. Certainly as you look to the way that Jesus models what his kingdom looks like, it's the most surprising, you know, from the cradle to the cross. You know, you don't expect there to be that kind of humility and service, and he's always defying the expectations of people who will say, come and seize power and take it. The one who offers him all the kingdoms of the world is Satan, you know. And so Jesus doesn't go the way of glorious power, and yet there's a remarkable reversal that takes place. That at the cross, the moment of greatest shame, we understand it now, it's the moment of glory. That the grave isn't the end, that the resurrection is. So I'm conscious I'm kind of talking in Christian shorthand and alluding to a lot of things, but if you want to understand it, Christian take on power, then I think the best place to do it is to read one of the Gospels and to, you know, read through John's Gospel or something like that. Do it with someone and see for yourself how he would have us act. And of course, the church has failed many times with that, and sometimes have been glorious. How should Christians respond while being laughed at? I think we should sometimes join in the laughter. Sometimes, you know, we should refuse it. But I think the story here is about laughing at the pretensions of power that's in the world. And I think we're meant to join in that. Why does God choose the Persians as the one who returned the Jews to Jerusalem? Is it significant that the authors name all the eunuchs and wise men by name? Well, this is a work of history. And so we'd see God working in history through particular people, who are sometimes quite outsiders, strangers to God. So Cyrus is named as the one who is going to be the anointed one to save God's people. That's how it's described in Isaiah. So that language about being the anointed one is the Christ. So here you've got a strange outsider being described as the one who God uses to save his people. So God is not a tribal deity. It's one of the things that's obvious to us and yet is so different in this ancient world where each empire kind of has its own understanding of who God is. Each city almost is like that. God will use the enemies of Israel to save Israel. Like there's a power to God which goes beyond the national borders of Israel. Thanks.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.